Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. I do not deserve it, but I'll take it. And thank you so much for inviting me here to speak with you, to think with you about my absolute favorite book in the whole wide world and my other favorite book in the whole wide world. It's such an honor and joy to be with all of you, and how your beautiful faces make my heart rejoice. This is such a beautiful place and such beautiful people. And I can't express to you what an honor it is. Now, it's impossible for me to speak of or even read Moby Dick without thrills of top-gallant delight, as Father Mapple would put it. And one of my favorite aspects of this book is Ishmael's frank humility delivered via his wry wit. A couple quotations that are pretty important to me and might be important to you in listening to me for the next little bit would be one from The Honor and Glory of Whaling, where he confidently asserts, "There are some enterprises in which a careful disorderliness is the true method." This is a method I often employ. Just be warned, more often unwillingly than willingly, but consequently, I hope your Lenten practices of patience will move the ears of your heart to forbear with my comments, which, though they never lack enthusiasm, sometimes lack the perfection of organization that one might desire. The other quotation I love, love, love is, "I care not to perform this part of my task methodically, but shall be content to produce the desired impression by separate citations. I take it the conclusion aimed at will naturally follow of itself." This is a guy after my own heart. So let's see if that happens. In 1928, William Faulkner wrote of Moby Dick, "I wish I had written that," admiring Ahab's sort of Golgotha of the heart, calling it immutable as bronze in the sonority of its plunging ruin, and lauding the novel's title character as a symbol of doom. Faulkner exclaimed, "There's magic in the very word, a white whale. White is a grand word, like a crash of mast trumpets, and Leviathan himself has a kind of placid, blundering majesty in his name. And then put them together, a death for Achilles." Now, it might be difficult to believe, hearing such a rush of praise, but Melville's whale book was not always so respected. Initially, reviews were mostly unenthusiastic. Whereas now, whether one has read the novel or not, the white whale is inescapable in Western culture. I hear about him almost every week somewhere. Piles of critical articles, puddles of self-published illustrated versions are now a thing, apparently. There was a Moby Dick opera in Dallas in the early 2000s. In 2019, a musical based on Moby Dick in Massachusetts. That would be interesting. And references in shows, movies, books, comics, pop songs, advertisements, all showing that the culturally ubiquitous white whale also has achieved a kind of immortality. And as Ishmael says, immortality is but ubiquity in time. For example, in 2013, in a Parks and Rec episode, Ron Swanson bristles, "I hate metaphors. That's why my favorite book is Moby Dick. No frou-frou symbolism, just a good, simple tale about a man who hates an animal." Now, that's intended to be ironic, but I think there's something to these words when you think about it. It seems to me that overeager and premature allegorical interpretation has, or can, kill the ability of the whale to do the work he's meant to do. This is my perspective. It seems to me that Ishmael's work is to recount and interpret his whaling experience and give the reader the ability to see what he saw. And I think that means first seeing the whale as a fish. You might not know this, but as for me and the white whale, it was certainly love at first sight. But that's not the way for everybody. Now, the first year that I had read the book, I was in a bookstore buying a copy of this beautiful book, and the young man at the counter remarked when he saw it, "That book would be pretty good if it weren't for all those hundreds of pages about whaling in the middle of it." I heard something suspiciously like that out in the hall right before I came in here. You know who you are. I felt irate, found myself saying to him, those are the most important parts. And that moved me to study it, to get more deeply into it. And it still seems to me that those chapters about wailing or the cetological chapters are the key to everything. So, but to give people who have this perspective their due, some of the claim, this is probably unfair, but I found an example of it on the, there was a condensed edition, entitled Moby Dick or the Whale, the Good Parts, 2009. And on the book it says, when this book was published in 1851, reading for pleasure was still a fairly new idea. There were no televisions, no movies, no MP3 players, no internet, and no cell phones. If you bought a book to read for pleasure, there'd better be a lot in it for your Yankee dollar. Melville knew his audience, and he knew he needed to add a lot of stuff to his plain sea tale to make it interesting to his readers. If he were publishing the book today, he would have written the book for us 21st century people and wouldn't have included a 3,000-word essay on the whiteness of the whale plopped down in the middle of a great and gripping story about monumental evil and passionate revenge. Okay. So, just imagine this, though. What if the whole novel is not just a great and gripping story about monumental evil and passionate revenge? What if that story, the story of Ahab, the grand, ungodly, godlike old man, this sea captain whose leg was shorn off by a huge sperm whale and who turns the whaling voyage of the Pequod into a personal voyage of retribution for his wound, what if that story is only one interwoven thread of the novel's fabric? That's how it seems to me. Now, some critics agree with me, or some critics suggest, that the larger movement of Melville's novel is a journey of knowledge. And the narrator, he who makes the famous opening request, call me Ishmael, is the main protagonist. Now, I call this journey Dantesque because in many ways it mirrors the Divine Comedy. Just as background, Melville did read Dante's Divine Comedy. And while for many years critics thought he only cared about the Inferno, research relatively recently, the 1990s, showed that Melville's copy of Dante was most heavily marked up in the Paradiso Canticle, which you could argue showed that he was most interested in the Paradiso, which I was very excited about because that's what I feel in Moby Dick, is a lot of Paradiso. Like Dante in the comedy, who is both the poet who tells of and the pilgrim who treks through the Inferno, who hikes up Mount Purgatory and ascends into paradise, Ishmael is both a member of the crew of the Pequod and a narrator who tells of what happened on that fatal voyage. His guide, Queequeg, the soothing savage who redeems Ishmael's splintered heart and rescues him from isolation, could be compared to Virgil as a guide. Though initially, Ishmael goes to sea in order to fight off what he calls the hypos, ultimately his journey is out of a kind of dark wood that he's experiencing, that damp, drizzly November in his soul. And this voyage will be more than just a substitute for pistol and ball, for there is a guiding hand that beckons him on to the Pequod, and he is preserved miraculously, effectively given an injunction, as was Dante, to return and tell of what he sees. So what does he see? What does Moby Dick have to teach us? It's my contention that Moby Dick shows us a crucial aspect of the created world and the place of humans within it. For Ishmael, the mind's journey is a deep dive into the unknown underpinnings of the universe, a Dantesque descent into the infernal darkness. However, both narrator and reader discover something hidden from everyday sight, revealed by the workings of the poetic imagination. By ardent attention and pursuit, the fiery hunt of the heart, Dante's unfailing affection, like Job's unflagging demand, and Ishmael's unrelenting investigation, there is all a similarity in this, like, poetic pursuit. And what they seek, a woman, a savior, a whale, is sought through these yearnings and seekings. But as they pursue their goal, the human spirit finds what was truly a terrifying tumble into the abyss becomes, unexpectedly, a dizzying and divinely aided ascent. He's going up. Interwoven with Ishmael's story of discovery is a story he tells about Ahab, as you all know. With awe, attention, affection, horror, compassion, and tenderness, Ishmael, who calls himself and admits to be a tragic dramatist, in Ahab depicts, quote, mortal indomitableness in its fullest sweep and direst swing. He acknowledges majesty and debasement together in the same man. But Ahab, he writes, my captain, still moves before me in all his Nantucket grimness and shagginess, and I must not conceal that I have only to do with a poor old whale hunter like him, and therefore all outward majestical trappings and housings are denied me. O Ahab, what shall be grand in thee? It must needs be plucked at from the skies and dived for in the deep and featured in the unbodied air. This magnetic sea captain captivates the entire crew, including Ishmael, and draws them on his fatal quest. His story is a lofty tragedy, revealing the astonishing heights and abysmal depths traversed by a noble human soul, as heartbreaking and fearful in its violence as it is rousing and ennobling in its dignity. But the overarching story, Ishmael's story, is a comedy, and not just because it is funny, really, really funny. And although Ishmael is witty, he's as witty as he is poetic. But it's comic because his is a flexible and humble, often bumbling, always receptive quest for knowledge that transforms. In some way, you could think of it like the tragedy of Pyramus and Thisbe being performed within the comedy of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Like there's a tragedy in a comedy, except imagine Macbeth wandering in and taking over Bottom's part. Ahab, like Oedipus, like Job, like Lear, wrestles with the order of the universe and the way it affects him personally. He feels the prodding of a spiritual power against him, and he takes it personally. When Starbuck exclaims, vengeance on a dumb brute that simply smote thee from blindest instinct, to be enraged with a dumb thing seems blasphemous. Ahab responds, all visible objects are but as pasteboard masks, but in each event, in the living act, the undoubted deed. There, some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If man will strike, strike through the mask. How can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall shoved near me. Acknowledging that there must be intelligence behind the movements of living creatures, Ahab is tortured by its hiddenness. He says, that inscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate, and be the white whale agent, or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. This mysterious aspect of how the divine shows or hides itself in the natural world torments Ahab until the end. He says much later in the book, in chapter 132, The Symphony, he ponders a similar thing. What is it, that nameless, inscrutable, unearthly thing? Is it? What cozening, hidden lord and master, and cruel, remorseless emperor commands me, that against all natural lovings and longings, I so keep pushing and crowding and jamming myself on all the time, recklessly making me ready to do what in my own proper natural heart I durst not so much as dare. Is Ahab Ahab? Is it I, God, or who that lifts this arm? But if the great sun move not of himself, but is an errand boy in heaven, nor one single star can revolve but by some invisible power, how then can this one small heart beat, this one small brain think thoughts, unless God does that beating, does that thinking, does that living, and not I? Those are some really good questions. Ahab here is, he's admitting, he sees that there has to be some divine power behind all of this. And that as a human, Ahab is unable to do anything without that power coming from God. St. Augustine would agree. But not only does he agonize over his inability to comprehend the divine order and how it is shown forth in the natural order, He's also dismayed that he can't understand even himself. In this wrestling, it seems to me he reveals a magnificent depth. Something about Ahab's noble soul, grand old heart, as Starbuck puts it, makes him stronger than most, and as a tragic epic hero also suffers more as he shoulders an ancient curse. He says, "I feel deadly faint, bowed and humped, as though I were Adam staggering beneath the piled centuries since paradise." This weight, pressure, this suffering he feels as he wrestles with his own rebellious nature within and without in the dangerous natural world move him to cry out like Lear, "God, God, God, crack my heart, stave my brain. By heaven, man." He speaks solitarily right before the first day of his chase of Moby Dick. He says, "We are turned round and round in this world like yon windlass, and fate is the handspike. Look, see yon albacore. Who put it into him to chase and fang that flying fish? Where do murderers go, man? Who's to doom when the judge himself is dragged to bar?" So it seems to me what he's saying about this curse, how he's suffering under the piled centuries since paradise, I hadn't seen it before, but I think there's something really crucial about that, that what Ahab's suffering so much about is some ancient curse. So he's puzzling over himself. He sees it within his own self. And it seems to him the same way that all of us wonder, why does he keep chasing that whale? And all the characters wonder, why does he keep chasing that whale? He's wondering the same thing about himself. He puzzles over this drive to pursue his hated foe. He seems perched, one could say, between the orbiting levels of fate and providence that Lady Philosophy and Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy, which Dante did read, and Melville read Dante, speaks of. And if you read Boethius, you know how she describes, like, if you think of orbiting spheres, the closer you get to the center, the more still you are. And she says, it's all the same movement of the same God turning the world, but when you're on the outside, it feels like fate, and when you're closer to the inside, there's a stillness and you feel the providence. Seems to me Ahab's kind of in between those levels, struggling with it. Okay, so it seems to me he's seeking a sacramental God, one that works in the natural world. And although the rituals whereby he pursues his desire often take the form of pretty pagan pursuits of power, underlying it all, it seems to me, is a sorrow and a longing, revealing and reminding one of what Peleg first told Ishmael before Ahab had even appeared. You remember this back in chapter 16. "I know what he is, a good man. Not a pious good man like Bildad, but a swearing good man, something like me. Only there's a good deal more of him. And once and for all, let me tell thee and assure the young man, it's better to sail with a moody good captain than a laughing bad one." This moody good man is loved by his crew, by Starbuck, by Ishmael, and his longing for a loving divinity emerges even as he asserts his mastery over natural powers. When in chapter 119, The Candles, he speaks to the white flame corpuscence that he hopes will light the way to the white whale, one feels as though he may as well be speaking to another greater spirit that also showed itself in tongues of flame. He says, "Whensoever I came, wheresoever I go, yet while I earthly live, the queenly personality lives in me and feels her royal rights. But war is pain and hate is woe. Come in the lowest form of love and I will kneel and kiss thee. But at thy highest, come as mere supernal power. And though thou launchest navies of full freighted worlds, there's that in here that still remains indifferent. O thou clear spirit, of thy fire thou madest me, and like a true child of fire, I breathe it back to thee." Now, I am talking about Ahab more than I intended to, but apparently he wanted to be talked about because I could not write about him. So what this passage, it just reminded me of this phrase Simone Weil in Waiting for God wrote, "The soul seeks nothing so much as contact with the beauty of the world or at a still higher level with God, but at the same time it flies from it." It seems to me these pages show Ahab in this torturous struggle. So since the Pequod's captain, in his explicit articulations as well as his silent acts, displays a noble but dangerous heroism manifested by his tireless efforts to penetrate the apparent falsity of nature. Ishmael, a member of the Pequod's crew and narrator of the novel, defends Ahab as a lofty hero of his tragic drama, and it seems to me that's why we love him, even though he's scary, even though he's dangerous. Since Ishmael loves him, I'm open to loving him too. Now the narrator, Ishmael, comic hero of his own enveloping story, is different from Ahab. He's wily, witty, rebellious, playful, pious, and irreverent, jocular, passionate, and imaginatively flexible, sponge-like in his absorption of knowledge of all kinds. And as a poet, he rarely takes the center stage of his own story in any grand way. He's nonetheless ever present as a fellow traveler, as a learner, as a lover of his shipmates, and especially of Ahab and the whale. Initially, he agrees with his leader, whom Captain Peleg called this grand, ungodly, godlike man. He agrees with him and hates the white whale before he even sees him. But subsequently, he gathers additional perspectives on the whale, and that's all those wonderful chapters that you love so much about the head and the tail and the spout, right? Yeah. The ambergris and the skeleton. As he gathers these perspectives, he explores the possibility that one may witness in the natural world analogies rather than dichotomous deceptions. So initially, though, despite this comic broadness of vision, and this is really fascinating to me, poetically, Ishmael clings to Ahab as the captain descends into his own hellish madness. And this is another way it seems to me there's a Dantesque descent. You've got to go down before you can go up. As Ishmael reveals Ahab's agonizing struggle with his own interior emotions, he describes a remarkable and terrifying transformation. Now listen, maybe you'll be terrified. Often, when forced from his hammock, this is about Ahab, by exhausting and intolerable vivid dreams of the night, which resuming his own intense thoughts throughout the day carried them on amid a clashing of frenzies, and whirled them round and round in his blazing brain till the very throbbing of his life spot became insufferable anguish. And when, as was sometimes the case, these spiritual throes in him heaved his being up from its base, and a chasm seemed opening in him, from which forked flames and lightning shot up, and accursed fiends beckoned him to leap down among them, when this hell in himself yawned beneath him, a wild cry would be heard through the ship, and with glaring eyes, Ahab would burst from his stateroom as though escaping from a bed that was on fire. What do you think's going on there? He's like seeing hell in himself. It seems to me when Ahab's own heart, this very throbbing of his life spot, I think that's what Ishmael means, becomes unbearable to him, an infernal abyss opens up within his own nature, and he can see it. Though Ishmael isn't with Ahab bodily when Ahab's in his room, poetically he's dwelling alongside the captain in this hellish horror. It sounds in some ways like a description of demonic possession, except that Ahab's mind's purpose forces itself against gods and demons. Seemingly, this purpose takes on a life of its own, frightening Ahab's common vitality or soul and inducing it to flee horror-stricken from the unbidden birth. This self-made spirit that possesses Ahab, born of his own intense thinking, so replaces and exiles Ahab's own proper soul that, quote, the tormented spirit that glared out of bodily eyes was for the time but a vacated thing, a formless being, a ray of living light, to be sure, but without an object of color, and therefore a blankness in itself. This image of living light that has no object of color is striking. Light without anything to color is impotent, I think. And a mind without a soul in a human, according to Ishmael's philosophical assessment, distinctly infernal. The compassion that Ishmael feels for Ahab does not lessen the simultaneous fear he feels and evinces in his address. He says, after describing all this, God help the old man, for thy thoughts have created a creature in thee, and he whose intense thinking thus makes him a Prometheus, a vulture feeds upon that heart forever, that vulture, the very creature he created. Ugh, it's terrifying. This image of light, though, fascinates me. Light without an object. This echoes a passage from Ishmael's passionate exegesis of what the white whale was to him in The Whiteness of the Whale. Magnificent chapter. This is what he asks, this question. Is it that by its indefiniteness, whiteness shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe? Or is it that as an in essence, whiteness is not so much a color as the visible absence of color, and at the same time the concrete of all colors? Is it for these reasons that there is such a dumb blankness full of meaning in a wide landscape of snows, a colorless all color of atheism from which we shrink? And when we consider that other theory of the natural philosophers, that all other earthly hues are but subtle deceits, not actually inherent in substances, but only laid on from without, so that all deified nature absolutely paints like the harlot, whose allurements cover nothing but the carnal house within. And when we proceed further and consider that the mystical cosmetic, which produces every one of her hues, the great principle of light, forever remains white or colorless in itself, and if operating without medium upon matter would touch all objects, even tulips and roses, with its own blank tinge. Pondering all this, the palsied universe lies before us a leper. It seems to me, and I'm bothered by this too, I recently took a painting class and the teacher kept saying, yeah, your eyes are really colorblind. There's not really color out there. It's just this sort of relation. I respect the science, but it's a terrifying theory that the colors that we see aren't really there. And it seems like Ishmael's horrified by this too, the idea that nature's lying to us. Whiteness carries such a frightening aspect with it, Ishmael argues, perhaps most powerfully because it reminds one of the scientific teaching that colors are not real. The beautiful, at least the way Ishmael's reading it, the beautiful natural world becomes a hell in itself, according to his reading of these natural philosophies. Ahab's quest to discover what is on the other side of the pasteboard masks becomes a philosophical journey into a hellish world, where what seems beautiful in our natural surroundings may be hiding a diseased and empty blankness of nothingness and unknowability. Okay, so we've gone down with Ahab into this sort of hellish region. Now, let's think about Dante briefly. In Canto 34 of the Inferno, while Dante is hanging onto his neck, Virgil is climbing down the shaggy loins of Satan. That's how he gets out, right? Do you remember that? And it seems like he's squeezing between the satanic fur and the ice. So the way that the translation Melville used goes, but night now reascends and it's time for parting. All is seen. And once the pilgrim has seen what he needs to see in hell, then he's told by Virgil to who will convey him in an unconventional way out of the lowest circle. And it says that Dante clipped him round the neck, for so he bade, and then when the wings enough were oped, caught fast the shaggy side and down from pile to pile or like hair, descending stepped between the thick fell and the jagged ice. Soon as he reached the point where at the thigh upon the swelling of the haunches turns, my leader there, with pain and struggling hard, turned round his head where his feet stood before and grappled at the fell as one who mounts that into hell methought we'd turn again. So as far as I can tell from this, Virgil climbs down until he reaches Satan's hip or bottom and then turns around, taking Dante with him. But whereas they were going down, now they're going up. They emerge into a world where they can see the stars and green plants and thereby can begin their journey up Mount Purgatory. Upon reflection, this is an astonishing way out of hell. It's weird. Dante had not been allowed to survey the underworld and return the way he came, like earlier epic heroes, right? When Odysseus goes, he goes back out the way he came. But instead, he has to actually touch the body of the Lord of the underworld, and not only that, but like use that body to exit the realm, like climbing on it. Dante goes absolutely all the way down into the underworld, not avoiding even the satanic hairy hips in his quest for divinely ordained saving knowledge and experience. as Dante, with Virgil for affectionate guide, must not simply go down into hell before they can ascend Mount Purgatory. So Ishmael, with Queequeg as his loving guide, will not only dive down into the infernal underwater regions, imaginatively, spiritually, and in some ways physically, following Ahab's journey into the abyss, but in order to rise to the surface with something fruitful and salvific to tell, he often necessarily and often haptically, like tangibly, must grab hold of the deep diving dwellers of the underworld. This is the Dantesque descent. You have to touch stuff. Once Dante and Virgil reach Satan's middle, they find themselves climbing not down but up. And likewise, Ishmael dives in headfirst in a cool, collected dive at death and destruction, imaginatively holding on to Ahab in his mania. But at some point, we find him climbing, ascending with the whale toward a more comic, more hopeful view of reality. But although Queequeg remains Ishmael's rescuer, even posthumously via the coffin, the body that Ishmael clings to in this quest is the whale's, and the whale is not Satan. This is where the ascent occurs. Okay, so I'm going to have to, in the interest of time, cut a few things out, but you can talk to me and I'll tell you about it afterwards. But let's think about, okay, Beatrice, right? So we've got Dante and Virgil, and then there's Beatrice. So who's Beatrice? As Beatrice's radiance increases as Dante and she ascend through the heavenly spheres, so the white whale's otherworldly beauty intensifies as Ishmael comes nearer him in thought, in imagination, and finally in Brock's proximity. So Beatrice in Moby Dick is the whale. Yes. So beautiful. Okay. All right. So Ishmael, those theological chapters that I love so much and you love so much, or you're going to love, they're really important because Ishmael begins with just this faint, vague idea of the whale. So initially, you've got the etymology, right? Contrary to common belief, the first lines of Moby Dick are not "Call me Ishmael," but they are supplied by a late consumptive usher to a grammar school. We're just given words for whale in other languages. And then after that, the extracts, the sub-sub-librarian provides pages of quotations from various sorts of literature, Bible, Plutarch, Rabelais, Shakespeare, Darwin, right? But those are still pretty abstract. It's just stuff people have said or written about whales. A glancing bird's eye view of what has been promiscuously said, thought, fancied, and sung of Leviathan, as he puts it. In Loomings chapter 1, upon welcoming a whaling voyage, Ishmael remembers the great floodgates of the wonder world swung open, and there floated into my inmost soul two and two endless processions of the whale, and midmost of them all, one grand hooded phantom like a snow hill in the air. So the whale's drawing him on, but it's just this phantom. It's bodiless at that point. Likewise, in cetology, he sorts the whales bodily according to size, which is wonderful, and he comes up with a brilliant and true definition, a spouting fish with a horizontal tail. We can talk about that more later if you want. but at every step in his journey, with humor and humility, Ishmael increases in knowledge and in kinds of knowledge. So it's not just more knowledge of the same kind, but they're different sorts. And he shares these discoveries. At first, he's moved against the white whale, as was Ahab, right? I, Ishmael, was one of that crew. My shouts had gone up with the rest. My oath had been welded with theirs. A wild, mystical, sympathetical feeling was in me. Ahab's quenchless feud seemed mine. But as a researcher and investigator, he continues to gather information about this famous creature, and without losing a depth of feeling about Moby Dick, he adds and fills out the whale's portrait. So he's not just this terrifying, phantom, scary monster. In the chapter named for Moby Dick himself, chapter 41, Ishmael describes the rumors of uncommon magnitude and malignity. But he allows that fabulous rumor naturally grow out of the very body. Fabulous rumors naturally grow out of the body of all surprising, terrible events as the smitten tree gives birth to its fungi. And that in maritime life, far more than in that of terra firma, wild rumors abound whenever there is any adequate reality for them to cling to. So he's allowing that the way that people describe the white whale might part of it be true, but some of it might be tall tales. So Okay, so all that said, what Ahab encountered was not just a rumor, right? He's got the lack of leg to show for it. Ishmael fills in the story for us. And this is what happened, according to Ishmael. Moby Dick had been chased. He'd turned around and faced the pursuers and wrecked the vessels. And then, quote, three boats stove around him. This is the captain that's weltering in the water. And oars and men both whirling in the eddies. One captain, seizing the line knife from his broken prow, had dashed at the whale as an Arkansas duelist at his foe, blindly seeking with a 6-inch blade to reach the fathom-deep life of the whale. That captain was Ahab. And then it was that suddenly, sweeping his sickle-shaped lower jaw beneath him, Moby Dick had reaped away Ahab's leg as a mower a blade of grass in the field. Remember that blade of grass. Small reason was there to doubt then that ever since that almost fatal encounter, Ahab had cherished a wild vindictiveness against the whale, all the more fell for that in his frantic morbidness he at last came to identify with him not only all his bodily woes, but all his intellectual and spiritual exasperations. The white whale swam before him as the monomaniac incarnation of all those malicious agencies which some deep men feel eating in them till they are left living on with half a heart and half a lung. He piled upon the white whale's hump the sum of all the general rage and hate felt by his whole race from Adam down. And then, as if his chest had been a mortar, he burst his hot heart's shell upon it. I just want to note, he struck first. In the duel. He started it. Just saying. Team whale. But anyways, I love Ahab too. This is the account of why Ahab hates the whale. This seems so important, and I hadn't seen this before, so I'm so excited to share this with you. The ancient punishment for the first sin, felt and accumulated over the millennia, is concentrated in this one man, and the angst at these ages of suffering is aimed at this one whale. It's amazing. It just makes so much sense. This animal, and it ennobles Ahab. He's carrying so much. This animal who, as the original pair who were meant to till the land and mow the grass in a paradise garden, those original two created people, but who instead became two orchard thieves, as Ishmael puts it. Remember them? And the two who brought down penal suffering upon all of us. This whale, who in that pre-theft world would have been submissive to the dominion of man, now becomes the mower. So man was supposed to be in charge of the animals, but they decided to rob the orchard. And now it's turned around. So the whale that would have been submissive now becomes the mower. So they were supposed to be the mowers, right? Take care of the garden. But now he's the mower. And as easily as cutting grass, shears away Ahab's leg. This is Ahab's anger and his woe. Okay, so I have to cut some things. All right, so let's think about... there's so much that Ahab sees more than that, right? And I'm going to have to push through and talk about the whale himself. But in all of those chapters, you've got the idea now, right? Learning about the blubber, the brains, the bones, all of this increasingly lets Ishmael get to know the whale as a real whale. And not just as a real whale, but a real whale with a real body. And we get all sorts of details about it. As he does this, it seems to me, he increasingly approaches a kind of paradisal peace. And I want to read to you from chapter 87, where we get an especially paradisal scene in the Grand Armada. So Ishmael, along with Starbuck and Queequeg, dragged into a region so unruffled it seemed a serene valley lake. So you've got the idea, right? Dantas descent, he goes down with Ahab into hell, and then the sort of purgatorio is like climbing out on the whale, getting to know him, going through all those amazing theological chapters. But as we sort of get higher up and closer to paradise, that's where I think the Grand Armada gives a little glimpse into this way, imaginative way of looking. So here, the sea presented that smooth, satin-like surface called the sleek, produced by the subtle moisture thrown off by the whale in his more quiet moods. And I just want to share something. I just read that there is a whaling museum in New Bedford where there's a whale skeleton that's 20 years old that's still dripping oil. 20 years. Those are oily, oily bones. So you can see why, when there's a lot of them around, they just the sea just gets very like sleek, right, from their whale oil. It's amazing. In this enchanted calm, surrounded by a circle of sperm whales, the whalers escape the panic of the hunted creatures and encounter whales so unafraid that they are able to be patted on the forehead. Then the whalers witness another and stranger world beneath the water's surface. The lake was, to a considerable depth, exceedingly transparent. And as human infants, while suckling, will calmly and fixedly gaze away from the breast, as if leading two different lives at the time, and while yet drawing mortal nourishment, be still spiritually feasting upon some unearthly reminiscence, even so did the young of these whales seem looking up toward us, but not at us, as if we were but a bit of gulfweed in their newborn sight. Floating on their sides, the mothers also seemed quietly eyeing us. This intimate gaze between whales and whalers is a momentary suspension of what Baynard Cowan calls the eternal enmity between man and nature. So they're normally, right, hunted and the hunters, but for a moment we get peace. This connection between humans and beasts also signifies a shift in the humans from aggressive searchers. They become contemplative witnesses to the subtlest secrets of the seas. And the gaze into the eyes of the infant and mother whales, it seems to me, is the natural analog of Beatrice's beautiful eyes, reflecting the divine to those who therein look. When after 400 or so pages of anticipation, Ahab finally snuffs up the sea air as a sagacious ship's dog will and smells Moby Dick before even seeing him, which I love. He smells before he's seen. The sleepers on the ship all awaken, as does the heart of the reader. The alluring confirmation of the proximity of a living sperm whale, given by the long sleek on the sea, smooth as oil, there's that oil again, and resembling in the pleated, watery wrinkles bordering it, the polished, metallic-like marks of some swift tide rip at the mouth of a deep, rapid stream. This signifies the intoxicating calm of the whale who left such a deep disturbance in the ocean as to render a rough ocean calm. I suspect you know the breathless lines of Hopkins, "My heart in hiding stirred for a bird." It seems to me one's blood sings in the same way in mere anticipation of the white whale's appearance. Ishmael himself acknowledges, "Other poets have warbled the praises of the soft eye of the antelope and the lovely plumage of the bird that never alights. The grace of these creatures is clear. That they deserve songs in their honor is not unclear." One may laugh initially when Ishmael allows less celestial, "I celebrate a tale." But by the time Moby Dick finally reveals himself, having learned of all the whale's parts, vital motions, including the five great motions peculiar to the irresistible tale, the Leviathan amours in the deep, his legend, his blood, his bones, his blubber, his babies, the stream of perfume ambergris that emerges from his rotting body. Having learned all this, when the eponymous whale finally emerges from the anonymity of the spirit spout, he and all his parts are in some sense, some real sense, more divine than the ruler of Olympus himself. And I say more divine because what Ahab misses in the whale is not missed by the humble Ishmael. To him, this whale reveals to Ishmael the incarnational nature of divinity. Okay, so I want to look now a bit at the chase, focusing particularly on how the white whale appears to the whalers and how Ahab reacts. Okay, you ready? Ready to go on a chase? Okay. I take Ishmael's descriptions as indicative of what he saw in the whale, whereas Ahab's words and actions are signs of his disposition, and they aren't always the same. So this is the first approach in the chase the first day. When they see him, they're lowering their boats. Like noiseless nautilus shells, the light prows sped through the sea, but only slowly they neared the foe. As they neared him, the ocean grew still more smooth, seemed drawing a carpet over its waves, seemed a noon meadow, so serenely it spread. At length the breathless hunter came so nigh his seemingly unsuspecting prey that his entire dazzling hump was distinctly visible, sliding along the sea as if an isolated thing and continually set in a revolving ring of finest, fleecy, greenest foam. He saw the vast, involved wrinkles of the slightly projecting head beyond. Before it, far out on the soft Turkish rugged waters, went the glistening white shadow from his broad milky forehead, a musical rippling playfully accompanying the shade. And behind, the blue waters interchangeably flowed over into the moving valley of his steady wake, and on either hand bright bubbles arose and danced by his side. But these were broken against the light toes of 100 of gay fowl softly feathering the sea. So everything is calm, joyful. The ocean is made by the whale's presence, serene as a noon meadow, like Neptune in the Aeneid slowly uprising to calm the storm that hassles Aeneas. Moby Dick brings tranquility to the sharkish sea. He's self-possessed. He seems to delight in his own divinity. And this comparison to the Olympian Ishmael himself makes. So he says when he sees Moby Dick, a gentle joyousness, a mighty mildness of repose and swiftness invested the gliding whale, not the white bull Jupiter swimming away with ravished Europa clinging to his graceful horns, his lovely leering eyes sideways intent upon the maid, with smooth, bewitching fleetness, rippling straight for the nuptial bower in Crete. Not Jove, not that great majesty supreme, did surpass the glorified white whale as he so divinely swam. One feels we are witnessing a sacred secret when we are allowed to see this creature so closely. How fitting that suddenly we are speaking of a god's nuptial bower. A hidden holiness of nature is glimpsed by these whalers, who initially embarked in order to get paid and continued as inspired by Ahab's powerful magnet mind and heart. On each side, coincident with the parted swell that but once laving him, then flowed so wide away, on each bright side, the whale shed off enticings. Such beauty allures powerfully. Moby Dick's calm joyousness is not weakness or stupidity. For those who make that mistake, danger awaits. Okay, so I'm going to have to close. But I'm just going to tell you a couple little more things. And one is that this whale, when he reveals himself again, when he's seen again, he lifts his whole forepart of him, and it says his whole marbleized body formed a high arch like Virginia's natural bridge, and warningly waved his bannered flukes in the air. This, the grand god revealed himself, sounded and went out of sight. This is his ascent. He's ascending and showing himself supremely. And Ishmael's making this connection to the traditional pagan gods because it seems to me this whale has been able now to show divinity. Now, what we didn't talk about much was Jonah and Job, but Ishmael's continually bringing up the books of Jonah and the books of Job. And when Father Mapple talks about the book of Jonah, what he says is God came to Jonah in the whale, that the whale is the way that God comes to him. And in the book of Job, what he says is, well, his final argument for himself is the Leviathan, which Ishmael reads as the whale. So, whereas when there's a sick whale and they're able to kill it, right? They're able to kill it. It seems to Ishmael there will be unfulfillments of the prophets, but there's finally a whale that vindicates the Lord's answer to Job. When the white whale tosses himself salmon-like to heaven, so suddenly seen in the blue plain of the sea and relieved against the still bluer margin of the sky, the spray that he raised for the moment intolerably glittered and glared like a glacier and stood there, gradually fading and fading from its first sparkling intensity to the dim mistiness of an advancing shower in a veil. This whale dazzles, like God speaking to Moses face to face, or like Christ to the Transfiguration, and he is attended by a cloud like God when he is spoken to by Abraham or Moses. Ahab's not moved by the radiant beauty, however. He just says, "Breach to your last, Moby Dick. Thy hour and thy harpoon are at hand." So it seems to me that, just got a little bit more. Ahab's death is a noble death. Ahab, by the way, I won't go into his death because I want to be reverent and you can just read it, but he's not killed by the whale, just so you know. So go back and notice that he stabs Moby Dick, but Moby Dick doesn't retaliate. Ishmael, as you know, is preserved and saved, and he, like Dante, is preserved to come back and tell of what he saw. Okay, so one last thing, two last things. Louise Cowan often would tell this sort of funny story about Donald Cowan. She'd say, as she was seeing things going bad, there was a war, there was another war, everything was getting bad, education was going bad, people are suffering, she'd say, everything's getting worse. And he'd say to her, you're right, we are falling in a rising elevator. It seems to me that that's what Moby Dick is, right? Ahab falls, he goes into the abyss, but the whole thing is coming up with the whale. I'm not saying that the whale is God, but Ishmael is able to see, and he's also not Satan, he's a whale. He's a really good-looking whale. But as Melville said this wonderful thing once when Hawthorne was corresponding with him, and he said, of course, his Moby Dick wasn't appreciated, and Melville said, well, is Jove appreciated? Why, ever since Adam, who has got to the meaning of his great allegory, the world? Then we pygmies must be content to have our paper allegories, but ill-comprehended. So that's what Ishmael sees, though. This is God's allegory. It's how he shows himself to us. That's what St. Paul sees in Romans, right? That the invisible things of God are seen in the visible things of earth. And I think Moby Dick shows this in an amazing way. Now, I want to leave you with a fantastic quotation from a letter of Melville to Hawthorne that I just think is wonderful. If ever, my dear Hawthorne, in the eternal times that are to come, you and I shall sit down in paradise in some little shady corner by ourselves, and if we shall by any means be able to smuggle a basket of champagne there, I won't believe in a temperance heaven. And if we shall then cross our celestial legs in the celestial grass that is forever tropical and strike our glasses and our heads together till both musically ring in concert, then, O my dear fellow mortal, how shall we pleasantly discourse of all the things manifold which now so distress us, when all the earth shall be but a reminiscence, yea, its final dissolution and antiquity. So this is what I hope for the whale and Ahab and Ishmael and me and all of you. Thank you so much.